Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. This week, we're talking to Max Propp, founder of Propp's Brewery, where he makes kombucha-based sodas. What started off as a college idea has now grown into a full-fledged family business. If you want to learn more about how kombucha is made, the products that Propp's make, or how Max scaled his college idea to selling now over 15,000 bottles a month, then this episode is for you. So give it a listen.
Max, welcome to the show. Could you please introduce yourself and tell us how Propp's Brewery got started?
Okay, yeah. My name is Max Propp, and I started Propp's Brewery, like, I think in the first year of COVID, when I was, like, graduating from university. It was like a graduation project. I had a project and I needed to start a business. And in the business, like, it needed to be with food, because my studies was like food design, it's called. And we needed to start like a business with that's food related. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So, like, where's the question, like, what kind of product and what kind of market do I want to go to? So I always had like kind of an interest in beer and wine and everything, but you saw like the market for alcohol, it was coming down. There was not like the demand wasn't growing for alcohol. So I already saw like, okay, there is like a lot of alcohol-free beers, but do I really want to do that? There is like a more mechanical process to making alcohol-free beer. So it's not like the fully natural thing to make it. So yeah, I kept searching and I kept searching. And at one point I heard from a family friend, like, oh, you should try look into other fermented sodas and kombucha in particular, because I'm also working with it for my skincare products. He has like he's working for Intercos in Italy, and he pointed me to it, and so yeah, I started with it. And at the same time, my mom was also like, okay, can't you do anything with like a drink that doesn't have like all the artificial sugars, because I can't drink them for some reason, I don't know why, and a drink that's also not as sugary as like the normal sodas and like the Coca-Colas and everything. So yeah, that together brought me to the kombucha story. And because I already had that interest in like in beers and brewing things and making things, I was like, oh, well, this might be interesting. And I started with it. And I think I first made two flavors with it for like that project. It was like some kind of blueberry with a gin kind of berry and an apple one. And in the end, we kept the apple one for the actual business, and we added some cinnamon to it. But yeah, the other one didn't make it, because it eventually was like, to make it in a on a big scale, it was too expensive to make. So yeah, but yeah, that's how I got to it. And after it, people just kept telling me, oh, you should do something with it, make a business out of it. But it was COVID, so there was not like a lot of market for it, because all the restaurants and all the cafes and everything, they were still closed. So we kind of started, and it was more like trying things and everything. It was more like experimenting at that stage. And when COVID really ended in when was it, like 2021?
Something like that.
Like at the beginning of the year, we really, like, we started to sell to restaurants and cafes and everything. But that also was, how to say it, a rocky start. Like, it was like, of course, every restaurant and every cafe at that point is very hesitant to take on new things, because they all, like, they survived COVID, like, as a business. And then to really take on a little bit more expensive product for them to to buy, it was like, no, for now it's too expensive for me. I'm not going to try new things for now. So that was like a lot of answers we got from businesses like cafes, restaurants and everything. So at that point, but we found ones, and then you see when it's going well there, others also say, oh, I also want to try that for my place, for my restaurant, for my cafe. And yeah, in that way we kept growing. So it's like a very natural growth we had from that start. So
yeah. So do you notice now then that after COVID, has it stabilized a bit more now that the restaurants are more likely to say, yes, we'll take on something new?
I think in general, the product also got more, like, it became more popular. When we started, people didn't really know it. And now it's more common. You can also find it in the supermarket now and everything. So a restaurant now says, oh, yeah, I like it. I like kombucha. And then they try and they're like, oh yeah, I want to sell this. So the also getting a new restaurant to sell your drinks now is way easier than it was before, because they already know the product often. So they are more prone to say yes instead of maybe, you know. And that's the whole, that's nice. I think it's a good trajectory also for us, but also for our competitors or like colleagues in that sense.
Nice. I'm curious though, because you started essentially as a graduation project.
Yeah.
And then you very naturally indeed went into starting it as a full-blown business. Yeah. But what kind of led you to realizing, oh crap, this can actually be a business that I could start and really pour my time and energy into? Because you also need that mindset to kind of push through the headwind that you had during COVID. So what kind of things really made you believe in the idea?
I think first of all, it was like, I always want to start something for myself, because when you for like the uni, I did a lot of I worked for a lot of other businesses and you took projects on there. And then often when you come there and you make something for them, you make a new product for them, they're like, this is what I want, but maybe I'm not going to work with it for now, or it's something for the future. Like, you give them advice, but in the end, they don't do much with it. And then you're like, oh, well, I think different about it. So I always was a little bit like, I think I might want to start my own business. And besides that, I saw a really upcoming market, because before COVID, like, I traveled a lot. And in every other country, you already saw kombucha and you already saw a lot of other, like, more craft drinks, like we like to call them. And then you go to a store here or like a restaurant and it's all the same. So I was like, maybe there is a market for it. And from there on, you just need to believe in yourself and think, I can do well. And from there on, it worked out like it did now, so that's a good...
Yeah, you never really made me think too much about the Dutch menu card around drinks, but it's always just the Coke, the Kosses, the Fanta, the iced tea. And then, indeed, when you go to places like Germany, you already have so many more craft drinks and things like this as well.
There's a lot more variety in what you can get, and over here it's a lot the same.
Copy-paste.
Yeah. Just one big brand, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Maybe what's interesting, though, is because kombucha has become relatively popular the last few years, but I don't think that, at least myself, even just from personal curiosity as a foodie, I'm not really too aware of how these fermented drinks are made and what goes into making them. So do you maybe want to explain the process a bit, like, of how you actually make kombucha?
Like, we make kefir and we make kombucha. It's the water kefir, but both work with a SCOBY. Mm-hmm. A SCOBY is like a shortcut for like symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. And a SCOBY on a kombucha looks like a big flat pancake that's floating on top of the sugary tea that you add to it. And so it's basically just a sugary tea you make, and you add your SCOBY and your starting liquid to it. And then you just let it ferment. It's like an open fermentation. So alcohol that's created, like, just evaporates. And then it stays in a vessel for about 4 to 5 weeks. And then you test it for, like, the sugar content and like, the acidity. And then you can make the kombucha flavor with it. So that's the whole process of it. It sounds easy, but it's a lot of controlling and a lot of tasting and, like, cleaning. That's the most important thing about everything, cleaning. But yeah, no, that's about the process. That's in short.
So it's quite a long process, right? You have to really plan ahead if it takes 5 weeks for it to get ready.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Do you have a lot of tanks then where you have, this is week one, that's week two, week three, or how does that work?
We have about, I think it's about 7,000 or 8,000 liters is brewing at the same time. So that's, we have 1,000-liter tanks that's brewing every time. So every week we have we can do a different batch for us or for others. And in that sense, every week we have 1,000 liters ready. So, and even if we have a shortage, you can split it. So 500 liters of this flavor, 500 liters of that flavor, or 1,000 liters of this flavor. So it's quite flexible. And if you if you let it like ferment longer, it becomes more acid, but then you can dilute it a bit, so you have more, or you can use a little bit more for the next batch, because you need to take 10% of the liquid of each batch to create a new fermentation.
Right. And is that the starting liquid you mentioned before?
Yeah, that's the starting liquid, and you add the SCOBY to it with new tea.
Yeah.
And that's how you start every time.
And is it the same SCOBY you use then for every time, or do you start like on a new one every time you start a new
every
batch?
Time, like, if you're like a hobby brewer, you can use the SCOBY, and every time we will create a new layer. Mm-hmm. But we often, after 1 or 2 times, we throw away the SCOBY because it's too big, and like, if you make 1,000 liters, it's a pretty big pancake you have over there. And then it becomes very heavy. So, yeah, we prefer to take it away. And also with that, we work together with a business in Utrecht. And they take the SCOBY and they make leather from it.
Whoa.
Oh.
So they, yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
As well.
And they make like a artificial leather from it because they found a good project with it, so I think they are doing well. Yeah.
Fair enough. How does the process actually create the flavor? Because we're drinking props right now.
Yeah.
And there you do get a bit of like this fermented flavor. You do get some acidity, like you said. And I looked at the sugar content and it's 4 grams per 100.
Yeah.
But it tastes sweeter than that. In my opinion, it's not overly sweet.
No,
but maybe it's the acidity or something like that that's doing it for me.
I think it's the acidity, and often in other drinks, you don't taste the sugar because they make it super, like that they turn up the acidity. For example, in a Coke, it's the same as lemon juice in acidity, but they add so much sugar so you don't taste it.
Oh my God!
That's why you can't clean, for example, your coins in Coke.
I thought it was the bubbles that did that.
No, it's the acidity.
Whoa.
So that's how
okay.
it works.
Okay.
I did not know that.
I did not know that. Yeah, no. I knew there was a lot of acid in it, because also like the story about putting a tooth in a Coke and then the day after the tooth is gone.
Yeah.
I knew that was about the acidity, but I didn't know there was that much acidity in a Coke.
That's crazy.
That's crazy, yeah.
Okay.
It's all about making your drink, like the expiry date as long as possible in the future. Oh. So that's why they do it.
Fair.
So then to get the acidity and everything right in props, there must have been a lot of trial and error and trying to get to the correct one in the beginning.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Just testing, and every I had like all these glass pots at home because I didn't have like the stainless steel ones because they were too big for like what I needed to make. So I had like a lot of glass like jars and pots and everything, and I would just brew kombucha and all of them, and each one had like a different sugar content in it for the starting of the fermentation and like how long they would brew each time. So that one had so much sugar and would brew for like 2 weeks, and the other one would have a little bit less sugar and would be brewing for longer. Like, and each time with each brew you would change the parameter. And then yeah, in the end you come to your most preferable recipe, I think. Mm-hmm. And we use the same base for every drink, and then we add the flavor.
Yeah.
Because people don't like it when you already also ferment the flavor in your kombucha. So, like, you know how fruit smells when it's getting fermented. So that's not what people want, and it's not nice to smell.
So you create a base, and then you add extracts, or you create like a flavor extract, or how does that work?
We use real fruit juices for everything.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And we try to get most like of them locally. Mm-hmm. So for example, the blueberry one, we get blueberries from Horst in the north of Limburg, and we make a juice from it, and then we add it to the kombucha. So you make you kind of make a syrup with it, and then it's like how drinks work. It's always a syrup with like a watery base you add to it to create the drink itself.
And that's also how you sterilize the blueberries. So you get some shelf life.
Each drink is sterilized, so it's
You sometimes hear people who make kombucha at home where they kind of open it and then it says boom.
Yeah.
You also sometimes hear about beers that are getting recalled because the beer bottles, they actually end up exploding because there was fermentation still going on once they've been bottled. With kombucha, is it that when you take the SCOBY out of it and you guys bottle it, is the fermentation then done? Or is there a chance that it happens again?
It can happen again, and that's also a mistake we made in the beginning, because sometimes people ask us, oh, is this drink like pasteurized or not? Because when you pasteurize it kills all the bacteria, and then it also stops the fermentation.
Yeah.
And that's a mistake we made in the beginning, because it sounds very romantic to have like all the good bacteria and everything. But we very quickly we noticed that restaurants and bars, they don't have like enough space to put every drink in a cool spot. So I think with one of the first batches we had, and we didn't like pasteurize it, people like a restaurant got it and one bottle said poof. So it kept fermenting inside of the bottle, and then the pressure is too high when you open it, and then it says it exploded. So
lessons from the early days.
And that's also what happens sometimes with beers and everything. Yeah. Then the pasteurization part didn't work well. And then there's still bacteria living in it. So then they explode.
I think also I can imagine that the process of refining the fermentation process in itself was quite a lot of testing and work. Mm-hmm. But also the flavors you guys sell, the ones that are here today, but also, for example, the apple one you named before that I've drunk in some restaurants here in Maastricht, they're quite unique. They're not like a normal thing, like blueberry with thyme, or there's like chili pepper in this one.
Yeah.
So what goes into the process of trying to like come up with these flavor constellations?
Oh, that's actually something that happens pretty natural, to be honest. Like sometimes I see a flavor and then like, oh, I want to do something with this kind of fruit or with this herb or this spice, whatever. And from there you start, and then I begin to add layers to it. So you start adding. You can try, for example, with the thyme, we tried rosemary. it's nice, but it doesn't really give you the mouthfeel I'm looking for, because we aim with every drink, you should get a different mouthfeel, like different like sensation. And that's also why we have the different flavors, because we think every flavor should have like a different role in the whole line we have, like in the whole assortment. And yeah, so we just have like a base, and from there on we start like building and building the flavor and adding or take away something and then add something else. And it's like a natural process. And at one point you're just like, oh, this is it, you know? And one time you have it after two tests, and the other time it's 100 like samples you need to make before you have the right flavor. So that's
Are there any crazy combinations that you've tried or that you can think of now that were a little outlandish maybe sounding?
Maybe I don't, for me, like nothing really is outlandish, but it's like they, we have the, like that bergamot with pink pepper and then also cardamom with it. So for a lot of people, that's, oh, that's special. I don't, they don't even know what half of it smells or tastes like. So it's, and you see like those flavors, they work very well in like fine dining restaurants, and for, because they really appreciate the complexity of it. And in more coffee places, some are like, oh, that's a bit too special for me, for example. So that's the whole thought process behind it.
But I think, I mean, I've tasted them as well, and they're done very palatably. Like, or that was a palatably? No. Yeah, they're very tasty. Yeah. they're very easy to drink. It's nothing nothing indeed outlandish when you taste it. No, but you can taste that it's special at least.
It's this, just the sound of the ingredients to people is like the way it sounds. I'm like, ooh, what's a bergamot? What's a cardamom? They are like, ooh.
Yeah,
what's and then there's pepper to it. That's a bit special for them.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
So it started as an idea at university or at school. And then now it's a family business. So you're running it together with your sister, Britt, and you've had a lot of support from your family and friends. How is it actually running a business with your sister?
I get that question a lot. I think it's very nice because it's really easy to tell each other the truth, to let's say it that way. And you can, like, sometimes we're not... We're having a fight, and then the next, like, in 5 minutes, it's already okay. It's already forgotten. It's because you know each other for so long. You know how to resolve things with each other. You know each other, like, perfectly well. And I think that makes it very easy to do business because we don't... There's also a lot of, like, non-verbal communication. Like, she knows... If I'm acting in a certain way, she knows, oh, well, I should leave him to be for this for 5 minutes and then I can come back. And she also knows when I don't like things and everything or when I really like things, and it's vice versa for me. So it's, I think it's easy. Yeah. For some people, it might be hard, but for me personally, it's very easy to do.
Yeah, I think it gets, comes down also to the relationship you have with your sister, right? Because I know people that have a hard time because both they're like, every time it's like fighting, and then you take it home and you're still fighting when you get home or when you have a family dinner. But if that really works, then that's amazing.
Yeah, indeed.
I don't know if I could run a business with my siblings. I think we could, but I think it would take a little bit of trial and error and some lessons and some hiccups. And
like we also, like when we are... young, you have that typical brother-sister relationship, like a lot of bickering and a lot of fighting together. But when we grew up, when we both grew up, it got way better. So and now we're doing it all together. So that's the nice part about it. And it also gives us a good, like how to say it, separation in what we both do. Like I do a lot of like producing, a lot of like, sampling for other businesses, like since I think last year we got like the second part of our business with it. So since then we also produce for other brands and businesses. And I do all the sampling for them and creating the new flavors for them and everything. And she does all the things you see for the website, the contact with everyone. And for us, it works very well in that way. So there's like a clear separation in what we both do within the business. So that also works nice for us.
Then you're not stepping on each other's toes the whole time and running around the production facilities. No. Like, damn it, Max, I already did this. And you guys were all shit, come on.
No. We have a clear... It's clear what we both need to do, so that's...
That also helps.
It works well, yeah.
I think that's definitely one of the parts that it works so well as well, because I've also heard from people that where you say they step on each other's toes all the time, then that's when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we also do, like, for example, production, we need to do it together. Like... making and filling the bottles, because the machine we have now, it takes two to operate it, and we do it together. But when we did that together, then we both can take our own part on again and go on. Yeah. So that's
I think also you just touched upon it. Yeah. You recently launched, I think, what's been coined Props Production.
Yeah.
So where you produce drinks for other companies.
Yeah.
What was the motivation to do this? Where did that idea come from?
It was more like of a... We had this opportunity to buy the filling machine and everything from a different kombucha brewer. And that also meant we would also take over his production. So we would also start producing for him. So it was like a good opportunity to also make like our own production easy, because at first we were filling with the hands, and now we would like do about 1,000 bottles a day. And now, like with the new machine, we are able to do 6,000 to 8,000 in a day and have them ready, labeled and everything within 2 days. So it's a big scale up for us. And yeah, but that also costs money. So we needed to take on the second part, like the production part, to generate extra money. And I also could have like a little bit of my creativity work for other brands and businesses, and I like doing that, so that's the creating part. So that was also, I think it was natural step for both of us.
Yeah,
it was, good.
I could also imagine that, like, now you have your line and your assortment of drinks, and I'm sure you know this will change as time goes on. It's probably already changed already, so that will keep happening. But I think if you get energy from that kind of work where you're creating new things, it's really nice to have that kind of input where you can create for other people.
Yeah.
And like you said before, sometimes you create for other people and they don't per se carry it forward. But with this, you have automatically the setup to start making it already and making it a reality as well. So I can imagine for you personally, it's also just a really fulfilling thing to add to the day-to-day production and things like this that you're already doing for Props Brewery itself.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. And you get so many interesting and cool projects on the way now and that are going on right now. And some of them are also very different from what I'm doing now. But that makes it also interesting for me, because with every project, you also learn something. So I think it adds to my skill set in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's.
And what kind of drinks are being made? Is it, then it's more than just kombucha that you're making with production, right? So could you give us an idea of what kind of things you're making? We are
currently also working for a Turkish franchise. And they are very big in Turkey themselves. So they have over 270 franchises in Turkey. And they are now expanding to Europe. And they are famous for their börek, And now they are starting that franchise in Europe, and they have this lemonade they sell with it. So we are making the syrup for the lemonade, because they have in all the franchises, they have this machine that people can like tap a lemonade. So we are making the syrup so people can tap the lemonade in all the franchises they are going to start in Europe. Next to that, I'm doing alcohol-free rum.
Okay.
For a brand that's called Mates Rum. They are from, I think, Delfzijl. That's actually I really like that project because our name is also going to be attached to it. And they just started a new, like, a side business. They have like Choco Mates, it's called. So that's chocolate milk with rum.
Mm-hmm.
And businesses can either buy these chocolate balls and then they get like a little bottle of rum with it, so people can make the rum chocolate at home. Or other like the more the walking cafes and everything you have over here, they buy a machine and they can have chocolate milk from them with the rum. And they had only had like the alcohol part of the rum. So now we are going to do the alcohol-free part of the rum, because yeah, you can't sell the Choco Mates without rum.
Mm.
That's the whole, like, I think the concept of it. And so they needed the part of the alcohol-free part, because a lot of big companies, they want to buy also like a gift for people, and then they can't sell them alcohol because they have a zero tolerance for alcohol. Mm-hmm. So they can't sell alcohol to them. So they were like, well, we need zero alcohol rum.
Yeah.
So that's...
That's cool. I've heard of Mates as well. I just had to look it up to double check if the label was correct in my mind, but I've seen them as well in the stores.
Yeah.
So it's cool.
And I think for now, that's about it in like projects that are going on, but there's already new ones starting, but I didn't touch them yet. So it's a big, we have our own project besides it of like expanding the brand. That's going to be the kefir one. We got like a research, like also a business in England. It's called The Good Culture. They are like, they help kombucha brewers and like soda makers. They have a lot of knowledge about brewing for businesses, if you're a bigger business. And they did a research and people actually liked acidity. They tested acidity in the research, where people liked the acidity of the kefir over like the normal acidity of a Coca-Cola. That's normally they made acidity, I think, with citric acid. Mm-hmm. So they preferred the kefir acid above the citric acid and above the kombucha acid. So now we're going to start like a whole new line with the kefir, because I think it's also our future, like a view we have for the future, that we can give our restaurants and cafes that are already a customer, they don't have to go to a different one for their cola, for their lemonade, for their everything else. So that's what we're also working on now.
Cool.
To get the whole range for businesses so they can get everything from us.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
I'm quite intrigued to know what the process is like. Like, let's say Stan and I, we want to get our first moves drink or something.
Yeah.
And we want you to produce it. Would we come and then say we want this kind of flavor profile, and then you go to work with that flavor profile? Or do we just kind of say we want this drink and you kind of let your creativity go and figure out what would taste nice?
It depends, because for example, the guys from the rum, they were like, okay, we want to have this flavor profile, but other times there's people that come like, oh, I want to have a kombucha, but you can do whatever with it, what you want. Mm-hmm. So it's very different than what people want. I just need to try and give them good enough samples every time for like, okay, to also see what you like and what you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in the end, the customer is king. And so if you would come to me with that question, I would start working, and then I would slowly start to like, okay, find out this is what he wants and this is what he doesn't want.
Yeah.
And then in the end, you can work towards something that works for you. So that's the...
And what about kefir? Because now you've piqued my interest. We learned about how kombucha is made, but what is kefir? You also said water kefir before.
Yeah, it's like there's two different kinds of kefir. One is milk, and you already often see it in the supermarket. It's like a yogurt kind of substance. And there is also the water one, and I think since a couple of weeks now, you can also find it in the supermarket, but it's very, in my opinion, it's very watery. But kefir is almost the same as kombucha. For kefir, like, a kombucha floats on top, and a kefir is in the bottom of the brewing vessel or pot or whatever you're using to brew it. And it doesn't use tea. So it's just sugary water, and it needs a fig and some lemon, and that's it.
Okay.
So you have a very neutral base.
Right.
That doesn't taste like anything, to be honest. So it's a very... you can go a lot of ways with it. It's like a very easy product to work with. Only to brew it is a bit harder.
Yeah.
It's a very fragile fermentation. It needs a lot of precise circumstances, and it needs to be constantly the same, or it's different every time. So it takes a bit more work. And that's what we're working on now to get it right.
Mm.
So, yeah.
I'm curious, because you gave us a little... ball of kefir, sample.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to try. And when it comes in stores, yours. Oh,
yeah. Then you already notes. Know it. That's also why you give it away, so people already learn the flavor of it.
Indeed. I think also you've sold over 32,000 bottles. You're in, I think now, 39, maybe more locations by now as well, depending on when the website was up.
I think 55 now.
Oh, 55.
Okay. And I think 32 was... 2023.
Okay.
So now the website needs to be updated again.
Yeah.
But I think now we're over... I think for our own, it's about over 50 or 60,000 now. And for others, it's a lot. What we filled extra for a lot of since September.
Yeah.
It's about, I think, now we almost do 15,000 bottles each month.
Oh wow.
Okay.
So
crazy. So props production is a really big part of the business.
Yes, it's going to be a very big part of the business, and super we like
cool.
doing it.
Yeah, of course, I can imagine. Oh, that's super cool. And how is it, because I know from my business, I mean, that was also to end consumers, and so I would be out, or I would get text messages from somebody. Even one time they'd seen a piece of this order clothing, I think it was in Sweden or Norway. You know, and I was like, well, it's super cool to get that message from someone. How is it for you to have this, essentially, a graduation school project where you're just thinking, okay, I've been given something, now what the hell do I need to do with it? So now having a company and you can see your drinks being enjoyed out and about, like, what is that experience like? Is it surreal? Is it fun? Is it weird? How is it?
I think in the beginning it's fun. And now, I think at some point, to be honest, it becomes a bit normal, because... you've seen it now so many times, and remember at the beginning you're like, oh, the lady next to me, she ordered one of our drinks, and you're like, oh, I'm curious what she thinks about it. But now it becomes so normal that people or friends that first didn't like it now also like it. So they that's how normal it became. And yeah, I think it's just a good feeling that people enjoy your drinks, the things you make. And that gives confidence for the future, to be precise in that.
I can imagine. I think it's a good thing that it's become normal, maybe.
Yeah.
Because then you can build on that.
Yeah, because people, at first they didn't know it, as I said before, they didn't know it. And now it's becoming more, they didn't want to drink it because it's like, oh, it's one of those hipster drinks from Amsterdam or something, you know? And now it's became normal to drink it. So then you also see more people joining in to drink it.
I think we touched upon some challenges before in the process and starting out, but have there been other things or times when you had planned something but it didn't go as planned and that you had to kind of change or adapt, or there was another challenge that hit your path?
Well, I think in the beginning there was like a lot of challenges because there's not, certainly back then, there was not a lot of like information about how can I fill a bottle with kombucha, or how can I brew it on a bigger scale, or how can I flavor it? Like, everybody would do it differently. So in a lot of ways, we always had to find our own way in doing it. And we created this process, like this, how to fill a bottle and like how to flavor everything and for ourselves. So it was like a lot of, looking to how they would fill a beer bottle and how they would fill like another soda bottle. But it's a little bit different in what it needs and like the order you do things and the steps you take to make the product ready for the end consumer. And I think the biggest, like not struggle, but eventually you're going to scale up things, and then to find the good partner for it. So like, for example, you first would order bottles somewhere, and then you need more and more and more and more. And to find a good partner in getting the bottles is pretty hard, to be honest, because it's often those businesses that are doing business to business, so they don't invest a lot of time and effort in being findable on the internet or something like that. Or they have like a website that looks kind of sketchy, but when you come there, they are really big. So then you're like, ooh, okay. And that was the biggest struggle, to find good partners for more products for the scale up.
And what's the biggest lesson you learned by being in business with the kombucha drinks and the other drinks as well?
I think it's having confidence in what you do is very important, because when you go to talk to someone and you're not confident about your own product, they will also not, they will feel it. You're not confident about it. So they will be like, ooh, he even doesn't like it, so why should I? So it's very important to be proud of yourself. And it's certainly a good advice to also sometimes look back at what you already did and where you came from, to appreciate what you already have. So that's I think that's a very important.
Very true.
Yeah.
I think also because when you want to creatively build things or do stuff, even if it's a more technical company like Sebastian's, you're always working towards improvement. So there's like a natural dissatisfaction that you always have, because you're like, oh, but what about this new thing? Or we can make it a little bit better. So then it's very easy to lose sight of the thing that you've already made. At least I had that all the time with this order, and now with my work as well. So
yeah, I also have it. Like, you always think, maybe this should be better next time, or that should be better next time. But at some point you need to realize, okay, this is good and people like it in this way. So, yeah, why should you change things? It's better to work on new things now, and you can change them in the future too. So it's, yeah, it's sometimes it's very important to be happy with your what you already have instead of being overly critical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, it's easier said than done.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I know.
Yeah, we definitely also know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, like, I think it's, we had a guest on the podcast a few weeks ago, and they said something along the lines of, you know, you have to be kind of embarrassed with the first versions of things that you make, and like look back and be like, just to see how far you've come now and what you're making now, to have that sense of confidence.
It makes sense. Yeah.
Like, I don't know, you probably have some first kombucha batches in your jars that were awful. Maybe.
Yeah.
You
know, so. Yeah, but still, sometimes I have to also make, like, samples for other people or for myself. And then I'm like, oh, no, this is not drinkable. And then you need to start over again because it's just not good.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, for example, with the rum, I was very, when I sent them the samples, I was very, like, how to say it? I was curious, but I wasn't entirely happy with where we, well, like where the project was at the point, at that moment. And I did send them to them, and they were like overly happy. They were like, oh, that's already way further than we thought you would be. And I was like, oh, well, but I didn't really like the flavor yet. But sometimes, like, I always want things perfect, and it wasn't perfect at that time yet. So you're like, well, you already had ideas to do it better. I think that's often the case, but you weren't there yet. So yeah, that was like a big learning lesson also for me, like a big lesson, because they don't know where you're coming from and where you already so they were already happy, very happy with like what I had, and what I had was already very good, but it wasn't, in my opinion, it wasn't, was just not yet there.
Right. Yeah. And there's always that time delay,
I guess.
Especially maybe if you're more in the, I mean, maybe not with the rum, but in the fermentation business, I could imagine there's always a bit of time delay, but
yeah, that's you know, true.
If you
just be happy with what you have already. And it's
fair enough.
So how are you planning on drawing props now to go cross-border and to become bigger in the Netherlands than what you are right now?
I think a big part of it is now like that we already have the bigger production facility than we had before. So that's already for to get the right partners to distribute it through the country. It's already, they would ask us, okay, so what's the production capacity you have, and like, how fast can you deliver us new ones, new bottles if we need them? Now with the bigger production facility that we have, that's already not an issue anymore. So that's one step we take. So now we are looking for the right like partners to distribute it through like to Amsterdam and the bigger cities. And then the other part we have is the other drinks, the kefir ones. That's how we think, especially in the future, with the less sugars, the natural ingredients you have in it. That might be a good like substitute for the current drinks that are on the market. And for the rest, I think after that we want to see, okay, first Belgium and then Germany. That might be an interesting market for us, but I think Germany is on hold still. First Belgium, and then we can grow further, step by step. You can't dream too big at this point.
I think that's a good thing that you say also. Like, it's not about not dreaming too big, but taking it
step by step,
not rushing too quick, because that's also what you see some companies, they go in and then they go like France, Luxembourg, Belgium, Germany, and then it goes too quick all of a sudden, and then you can't follow with the scale up, and that's that's an important part of business, knowing when to really push and when to just say, okay, we go one country by one country.
Yeah. And doing it half-assed maybe, where you're just kind of like, okay, we'll do six countries, but we'll give them each, you know, a tenth of our attention because you have things inside the company to do. Yeah. And then you can't keep track of what's going on.
Yeah, and I think if we grow that big, then there's also the part of like employing people and everything.
Yeah.
So that's also a part that we first need to like find out how it all works. And if you find the right people, like you first need to find the right people. So yeah, it's also sometimes a lot of other like entrepreneurs, they tell me, wait as long with like employees. Just try to keep away from employees as long as you can. But yeah.
At some point, you need them.
Yeah.
At some point, you need them. Yeah. So it's
absolutely.
Yeah. And then it's just the important part of onboarding the right people, because so that you avoid someone who comes on and is there for a month and then is sick for the next 8 months, and you have to pay them for the salary. I mean, they can actually get sick, right? But there's also some people who play on it. That's a difficult part.
Many horror stories.
But it can also be a very fun part, right? Because then you're actually really growing the company at that point.
Also, many success stories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Stories both ways.
Yeah, like, I think it's hard because in that sense, sometimes I think, okay, well, I have a lot of friends in the food business. So then you think, okay, maybe it's good to take them on board. But on the other hand, like, I work with my sister, and to work with friends is a different thing. Mm. So I'm not sure if I, in the end, want to do that or not. Mm. If you can keep it separate, then it's good.
Mm.
So then they would work more for my sister than they would work for me.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's something that's too smart to do at this point in time.
Fair.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Max, to wrap up, we ask all our guests to bring an object of personal significance. Yeah. What did you bring today and why?
I brought this beer gun. It's called. This is the thing we used till last, I think it was September, to fill our bottles. It's actually a very simple part of machinery, how to call it. But actually, like, this part goes into the bottle. You would first then spray it with CO2 to flush out all the air. To like prevent oxidation of the drink, and then you could fill it, and that was something we did with our left hand. We would fill it like this, and with the right hand we would take it to the bottle cap machine and put it on there. So it was like we would always be doing two things at the same time. And I remember before we got this thing, this was one of the last things I got before we could really produce. But before I got this, like, this tool, machine, whatever it's called, I saw on the internet, like, and I read on beer websites for how to fill your bottles. You could do it with like a hose and everything. So I was trying that, but it didn't work very well. And then after like asking for a lot of advice from this, website where you can buy a lot of like brewing tools and like ingredients, they told me, well you can try this thing, and if it doesn't work, you can send it back to us. So they were very kind for me, and I tried it and it worked very well. And since then, I think this thing filled over 60,000 bottles in those years, and now it's retired.
Nice. Yeah. Well, it did its job very well.
It did its job, and for the money it cost us, it was it did a very good job. So that's the, I think it was, that was why I took it.
Fair enough. Your left index finger must be ripped. By the way.
It was like at some point you did it with two fingers because it's too heavy. You can try it if you want to.
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah, I can imagine
if you do
1,000 of those a day.
It's
nice.
Yeah, okay.
1,000 times.
That you're going to feel in the in the arm.
Yeah.
Nice. I feel like an assassin.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we caught you at a very exciting time.
Yes.
You've laid some foundation, and now it seems like you're really, at least, I mean, we barely know you, but it sounds like things are really stacking up. So super exciting. I hope to see props as the new healthier alternative to cola and Fanta and things like this.
I hope it too.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you for your time, and I look forward to drinking more and more.
Yeah. So do I.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Max. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of First Moves. If you want to connect with our guests personally, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram called First Moves Podcast. And lastly, if you could take a moment to leave a review, it helps us make the show better for you, but also helps us get even better and more insightful guests over the long run. Thank you very much, and have a great day.